It's the third and final hour of the 9 till noon show this morning. A few comments. We spoke to Emily Hurricane before the break about etiquette. Caller says, it's how parents rear their children that they know how to behave. I still do as my parents taught me. And my motto is, my house, my rules. A young man offered my little girl a seat on the bus and I just thought how lovely he was. Didn't accept his offer, but it was very much appreciated. Now, on the other side of the fence, as it were, caller says, I'm 60. I was highly insulted when a mother made her child get up and give his seat to me. I'm healthy, fit and still work. I run 10k a day. I don't need this etiquette carry on. We're all equal. Now, we're pretty much the same age because I am 59 and I hit 60 next year. I don't run 10k a day. I walk 6 or 7 at least. But I think etiquette, it's not that if someone offered me a seat, I would say, thanks, but I'm fine, thank you. And it has happened. And I think, you know, there is no onus on someone who's offered a seat. I mean, I do remember the first time we all have these indicators that we're getting old. I often think one of the worst I had was shortly after I turned 55, I got a letter from On Post, and it was essentially telling me that as an older person, I now qualify for a special funeral policy. And then realised, doing several stories over the years about initiatives for older people and initiatives for elderly citizens, and realising I qualify for inclusion in every one of them. That's a little bit of a kick. But, I mean, look, if someone offered me a seat, I would say, no, I'm fine, thanks. It has happened on the Lewis in Dublin during trips down there. I wouldn't be insulted, certainly wouldn't. Caller says, if I was visiting your home and your landline rang, I would expect you to answer it. Why not answer your mobile? If my mobile rang, I would take a very quick and hopefully subtle look. Now, I try to do subtle. I can't do subtle. But I would try to take a subtle look. If it was important, I would say, excuse me, and answer it. The issue isn't so much answering your phone. The issue is picking up your phone and just starting to check texts and send messages and so on and so forth. Another man says, as a male, if I keep one more door open for one more woman who says, I can open it myself, I swear, I'd bang her in their face. Take a decent gesture as a kind thing. Everything doesn't have to be an issue. And yeah, do you know what? It goes back to the same thing. Look, I mean, if someone holds a door open, I will hold a door open for anyone. I don't care if it's a man or if it's a woman or it's young or old or whatever. If I am at a door and there is someone walking toward the door, and be they carrying shopping or whatever, I mean, it takes me approximately 3 seconds to stand there and hold a door for someone. I mean, you know, it's not hard. And it's not like, you know, you only do it for older people or whatever. You know, and if someone holds a door, you say, thanks, and you go about your day. And they do the same thing. Right, let's change the subject, because sometimes we talk about things and their ideas, and we have a vision of life, and we plan out our life, and we advise other people on what to do about their lives. And that was the case with Georgie Crawford, a life coach, a podcaster, telling people all about, you know, how to make their life better. And then in 2017, she got some use, which suddenly made her reevaluate everything. And the upshot of all that is the publication of a book that's now come out. The book is called Glow, 5 Steps to Create the Life You Dream About. Georgie Crawford, good morning.
Good morning, how are you?
Very well indeed, thank you. Georgie, you, as we said, you've been podcasting and you've been a life coach for 10 years, and you'd been working away in the job, and you'd been doing it and doing it very well, no doubt. And then in 2017, fair to say for you, everything changed.
Yeah, so before I got cancer in 2017, I worked in radio, and I worked in a newsroom, and life was just busy. I was working around the clock, trying really hard to get a promotion, you know, really wanted to excel in my life. I got married, I had my first baby, and unfortunately then, when my first child was 7 months old, I found a lump in my breast, and 5 days later, I was diagnosed with cancer. So I went on an incredible journey. I had 5 months of chemotherapy, 4 weeks of radiotherapy, and really just transformed my life coming through my treatment journey. And so here I am 5 years later, cancer-free, with my first book under my belt. Mm.
And you do sort of say that there is a huge difference between thinking about how to make your life look good and then thinking about how to make your life be good. And that's one of the sort of slightly subtle but important messages you've brought into this book. It's not about looking good. It's about actually being good.
Yeah, I think for so many years, I was diagnosed with cancer when I was 32. So I suppose for all of my 20s and early into my 30s, I existed entirely for my outer world. So what people thought of me, you know, what promotion I had, what car I drove, you know, all of the things that probably consume a lot of young people. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But I suppose throughout my journey and work and trying to get that promotion and just being fixated on one outcome, I kind of lost touch with myself. And over that time, I didn't know who I was anymore, what made me happy. I always told myself, I'll be happy when I get the promotion, I'll be happy when. And that was really the kind of story that went around and around and around in my head. So when I went through treatment and I realized that actually I have everything I need, you know, if it starts with loving myself and I work from the inside out instead of the outside in, everything actually started to transform. I got the promotion. Things started to go my way. People started to tell me I was glowing. I started running. Like, everything in my life transformed. When I infused my days with time, you know, discovered who am I actually and who do I want to be and where do I actually really want to go in life. And it was only when I gave myself that time, I suppose, that everything changed for the better.
The word you're using for the title of the book is glow. And it's an interesting word because it's a word that's going to give a sort of a different image to everybody, I suspect. And I'm going to tell you what the when I saw the title, the first image I get when I see the word glow is, you may remember the ads for Ready Brick that used to be on TV years ago, where the idea being there was a kid standing at a rainy bus stop and the kid had had their hot Ready Brick for breakfast and there was this orange glow coming out of their belly. And when I see the word glow, that's, but what that word says to me is it says sustenance, it says warmth, it says ready for the day. And from that, and even though the image I get is an image from a Ready Brick ad on television, it's the perfect title for the book.
Absolutely. And that's the perfect analogy, I suppose, because that child standing at the bus stop had looked after himself before he went out into the world, you know, and he was ready to face the day having looked after himself first. And in my recovery from cancer, people started to tell me I was glowing. I discovered, you know, really healthy food. I was hydrating myself. I was going for little jogs around the block. And really, I was glowing, but the glow was coming from the inside out. And that's really what the book is about. It's about how to connect with yourself. It's not about like setting goals and making a 21-day plan. It's about really just stripping it all away, sitting with yourself, connecting with yourself. And when you do that first, then everything in your outer world starts to evolve. Everything starts to work for you. So there's 5 steps in the book and it's really easy to follow. You can do it within the 4 walls of your own home. And the feedback that I'm getting from women really is the word relatable. People feel seen. It's very normal, you know, it's just a normal account of a girl who just started loving herself and then everything started to change.
To what extent, and forgive the bluntness of this question, to what extent are these changes driven by a feeling perhaps in the back of your head that I was expecting something to happen in 2 years or 5 years or 7 years or 8 years? But maybe now there aren't 5 years. Maybe now there aren't 7 years. Maybe there aren't even 3 years. And that almost unconsciously gives you a drive that it effectively takes away that, oh, I can do it in 7 years' time. Maybe I can't do it in 7 years' time, so I better do it now.
That's a really good question. And I have four or five short stories in the book, and one of them is called The Burnt Potato. So my husband, Jamie, was diagnosed with MS when we were dating, and our whole life revolved around his health and keeping him well. And anyone who's listening maybe is able to relate if they look after a sick parent or child or partner. And you just want that person to be well. And you tell yourself, I'll be fine, I'll survive. So I always ate the burnt bit of the dinner. And it's really a metaphor for, I always, you know, did the ironing. I always did the housework. I always sacrificed myself for the sake of everyone else. So when I was sitting in my garden, you know, during my chemotherapy journey, I was like, how did I expect to survive that? How did I expect to thrive when I was so far down my own to-do list? And actually, when you become important to yourself, other people start to think you're important. So that's when my life started to work for me. And lots of people are relating to the burnt potato story, because we do kind of live in this world where we tell ourselves that we'll survive, and we're burning the candle at both ends. And I just wanted women out there to know that they don't have to live that way. And when I was sitting in my garden thinking about my little girl, Pia, and, you know, she was 1 year old, and I was like, God, what's going to happen to me? Why didn't I look after myself in a more loving way? And, you know, I don't eat the burnt potato now because I don't want Pia to eat the burnt potato when she gets older. So I suppose it's about breaking the cycle too.
You also make the point, and it, one of the five steps you do reference, and I find this one interesting. You say, don't do for others what they can do for themselves. And it is an interesting one, because maybe sometimes we almost unconsciously take tasks upon ourselves on the assumption that we're the only person who's able to do it. And then suddenly we realize that if I'm not there to do it, well, it'll still get done. It'll not be an issue. And in a week's time, no one's going to know who did or who didn't do it. So, you know, on every level, perhaps that's something that we have to do. Not so much because we need to force other people to do it, but we need to force ourselves to stop.
Yeah, and I think that's, I had the disease to please. So I have like five steps in how you can stop people pleasing. And that is one of the steps, you know, don't do for others what they can do for themselves. And really, I suppose, like, I want to do everything for my family, and I want to protect them, and I want to keep them safe, and I want to make their life as easy as possible. But actually, I'm doing no favorites for my child. You know, not teaching her how to look after herself, how to get herself ready for school, how to dress herself. And I suppose with the cancer, I was forced to surrender. I was forced for people around me to, you know, figure it out for themselves, for Jamie, my husband, to step up to the plate and really, you know, take the parenting 50-50. Yeah. And I was definitely forced into that. But I wanted to show people that you don't have to get sick to make changes. Yeah. You know, the worst doesn't have to happen in order for you to start really caring about yourself.
Yeah.
So I hope that, you know, the book helps people along their journey through life.
And I'll bet Jamie sort of exceeded your expectations as well, that he was able to step up to the plate. And then that nearly begs the question, because you were doing everything for him before that, were you potentially hampering his growth?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, like, one of the things that I always said about getting cancer, because there's so much horrible things that come with the cancer diagnosis. Mm-hmm. But one thing I learned from my cancer diagnosis was I saw my child's relationships with other people grow. And, you know, Jamie and Pia are best friends now. He's the most incredible father. But you know, I had to step back a little bit. I was forced to. But seeing those relationships, like seeing my child laugh the same way she does with me, with my mum and my stepdad or Jamie, just made me a little bit less scared about what I was facing. So really just kind of, I suppose, just letting her fly. And, you know, it took me a long, long time to say that cancer gave me more than it took from me. And I know everyone's cancer journey is different. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's almost like it took me by the shoulders and turned me in a different direction. And I hear from women now who are being diagnosed with breast cancer around the country. And my message to them is just see where it can take you. And I know it is so scary, but if you're open to the journey, I swear to God, it's not all bad.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more with that. The Good Glow podcast is the podcast you have. That's available, I take it, on all reputable and other platforms. And the book, and if you're watching this on YouTube or on our Facebook page, you can see I'm holding the book. It's Glow, Five Steps to Create the Life You Dream About by Georgie Crawford. Georgie, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. That's Georgie there. Glow, the Glow podcast is the podcast. And as we said, as well as that, you can pick up that book. It's on Hatchet Press. It's Glow, the Five Steps to create the life that you dream about. A very good morning to you, and you're welcome to the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. It's time for our Wellness Wednesday spot, and today we're discussing Hemochromatosis Awareness Week, which is running this week. It runs until June the 8th, which is tomorrow. Joined by Moira Jackman, who has hemochromatosis and is going to tell us something of it. Basically, what hemochromatosis is, just to give you a very brief background, it's a hereditary condition in which excessive amounts of iron are absorbed from the diet. That iron is then deposited in various organs, mainly in the parenchymal cells of the liver and also in the pancreas, the heart, the anterior pituitary, and in the joints. Early diagnosis is vital because without treatment, hemochromatosis can cause premature death. It results from a fault in a gene known as the HFE gene. And now we'll just switch from Zoom to the phone, and hopefully we have Moira. Moira, good morning.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
Very well indeed. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on the
program
this morning. It's our pleasure. Moira, we were just discussing briefly there what hemochromatosis actually is. Give us an insight from your point of view as someone who lives with hemochromatosis, what it means.
The explanation really is too much iron in your body. It's a genetic disorder, and it's where large amounts of iron are absorbed from the diet into vital organs such as the liver, heart, lungs and body tissue. We refer to it as iron overload. Now, it can be fatal, and that's the message I suppose I'd like to bring across to your listeners today. It can be fatal if not detected early. And it's the most common genetic disorder. One in five people are carriers, but one in about 20% of the population actually have this disorder. So I was diagnosed with it about 5 years ago after my brother was diagnosed with it. And the reason I was diagnosed was obviously he was diagnosed with it, but I wouldn't have known I had it. Only he had been going with problems with his limbs and his joints and stuff like that. So if he hadn't been diagnosed, I mightn't be around today. My father died at 58 from this disorder.
And you discovered your grandfather died at 57 as well.
Yeah, that's right.
And in both cases, they would have been undiagnosed.
Undiagnosed. It wasn't known at the
time. Well, in terms of, I mean, how much impact does this have on you on a day-to-day basis? Because presumably it means you have to watch your diet. Presumably it means you have to take tablets and medication. I mean, are you allowed through management to live a normal life? What impact is this going to have on you on a day-to-day basis?
Okay, so the really good news is once it's diagnosed, there's a simple solution. That's just getting blood taken to bring down your ferritin levels. So so you can live a very normal life. The diet, you have to be eating a lorry load of broccoli or drinking a load of Guinness for it to build back up again. The iron builds up over years from your diet. But getting one venesection, which is the mechanism to get rid of blood, would get rid of an awful lot of, you know, quite a lot of the iron, you know.
Are you limited in the amount of red meat you can eat, for instance, because that's the sort of food that would be...
They say not to be eating a huge amount of red meat, but you can have some red meat. It's all in moderation, really. But the diet isn't a huge thing. It's actually detection and, you know, getting your venesections regularly is the key. And the messages, I suppose, the Hemochromatosis Association would like to get out there today is that if you have it, tell your family. And secondly, that we'd like to see a national strategy for hemochromatosis, which is in the process of being, it's been developed and it's been presented to the government. And we're hoping that there'll be more awareness made of it.
Now, the figures are that one in five carry that faulty HFE gene that can lead to full hemochromatosis, and it's reckoned one in 83 people in the country have that condition. What percentage of those would be undiagnosed?
I wouldn't know exactly what percentage, but haven't been diagnosed. There's been research up in the north of Ireland which would indicate that there's an awful lot more than one in 83 people have hemochromatosis. But, you know, we don't know at this moment in time. So a screening program would be very useful to have to be able to detect how many people are going around hemochromatosis. Yeah.
Now, we're told that Ireland has a higher concentration of this in the population than any other country in the world. Do we know why that is?
No, actually, not. No, I don't know why that is. Sorry about that now.
It is an interesting one. Because,
it is very, very interesting, yeah.
Because you would have thought our diet isn't that different, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's just one of those things. And it's a piece of research that I'm sure the Hemochromatosis Association are looking into at the moment.
In terms of the drawing out of the blood, I mean, obviously you have to go to hospital on a regular basis to get this checked with your GPs and blood tests and so on and so forth. How often do you have to go through that actual process to effectively cleanse out your body?
Okay, so when I was diagnosed with hemochromatosis, my levels of ferritin were at 1,400. The normal level is about 15 to 200 in women. Yeah. So mine were way up. So that meant that my iron levels were so high that they were going to affect my organs. So I started going to get finisections and I was getting them weekly. Now my levels are right down to about 350. They're at fairly manageable levels, but yeah. I still need to get them down because you'll feel very tired with that level of iron in your body.
Do you have to take tablets or treatments on a day-to-day basis, or is it just however often the finisections are necessary?
However often the finisections are necessary, and it's a very easy, very, very easy process. Go into your hospital or your doctor. It's just like giving blood. If you were giving blood for the transfusion service, that's exactly what it is. And they'll take your unit of blood, and that'll bring down your iron levels, and you'll be your bloods will be tested again to see how high they are. And it's just a process like that. So the only really disadvantage really to having it, as long as you're managing it, is having to go and get a venesection, which isn't a big deal.
Yeah. Is there any home test you can do yourself to sort of determine when a venesection is needed, or do you just have to go to your GP or go to the hospital on a regular basis and get tested there?
Yeah, get tested. No, I go to the hospital. There's no home kits at the moment. It's something worth thinking about, I think, and maybe it is something the Hemochromatosis Association will look into. But at the moment, we just do a blood test. A blood test will always show if your levels of iron are high. Now, normally, if you go to the doctor to get your blood tests done, iron isn't really one of those things that's normally done. So you need to ask the doctor to say, listen, can you do the iron test? And that will show if you're certain levels are very high, and if they are, it's a good indicator that you have hemochromatosis.
Maura, thanks indeed for speaking to us this morning. We wish you all the best, and as you said, you're with the Hemochromatosis Association. We can presume that if 1 in 83 people in the country have this, then a lot of people are out there with it and they don't realise they have it. You know more than anyone the pain of premature death as a result of this, you've having lost both your father and your grandfather at ages now younger than yourself. If we can prevent that from happening to other families, it'll be a job well done. And I mean, what if people, as you say, if people are feeling tired in terms of symptoms, how should people know to go and get tested, to go and get a consultation on this? What sort of symptoms would you be building up?
You know, even their GP. Well, the symptoms really, I suppose, tiredness, chronic fatigue was my one, abdominal pain, diminished sex drive or impotence, arthritis, you know, all those things, skin pigmentation, it can lead to diabetes, arthritis and liver disorder. So, look, if you have any idea that you have any of these symptoms, or even if you're just going to your doctor getting your bloods, no harm to say, do an iron test, see what my iron levels are like. And it will show. But I will say I could be dead today if my brother wasn't diagnosed, because I didn't have any great symptoms myself, you know. So whilst I was sitting in blissful ignorance, I had a very high ferritin level of 1,400, while the norm is 15 to 200 in women. So it was damaging my organs. Thankfully, I got it in time. there's no reason today, Greg, that we can't have some form of screening. Back in those days, you can't blame anyone because it wasn't even known about. But today we know about it, and this is what today is about. And this is why we're on the radio doing these interviews. And we really appreciate the stations like your own giving us airtime.
It's our pleasure, as we say. This is what we call our Wellness Wednesday spot. And what better way to use it than to raise awareness of a condition that many of our listeners may unknowingly actually have. Mario, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you.
Thank you. That's Moira Jackson. Jackman there. Apologies, Moira. That's Moira Jackman speaking to us there. And it's as she said there, if you're feeling any of those symptoms, just briefly run down through them again. Unexplained weakness or fatigue, abdominal pain, diminished sex drive or impotence, arthritis, particularly in the knuckles and the ankles, diabetes, liver disorders, discoloration of the skin, mood swings, irritability, abnormal heart rhythm. And, you know, they can be indications that you may have hemochromatosis. And go see your GP, take advice from your doctor and see what the situation can be. You may find it is, as happened in the case of Moira and her brother, a life-saving consultation. Could you please play a request for my mum's 87th birthday today? Madge Callaghan of Grove Hall in Remelton. That's from Lavinia, who's in Birmingham in the UK. She'll see you in August with great-grandson Rhys. Have a wonderful day. And that's from Lavinia. So, Madge Callaghan, Grove Hall, Remelton, have an absolutely wonderful day.
Watch the show live now on YouTube, Facebook and at highlandradio.com.
And you're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. It's a Wednesday. It's just gone 11:30 to be precise. It is 22 minutes to 12 noon. And that can only mean one thing.
Business Matters in association with the ATU Donegal Faculty of Business. If you have an undergrad in any discipline and would like to reinforce it with a Master's in Business, ATU are offering their Master's in Business Management Conversion Programme. Call 9186206 or email donald.hannigan@atu.ie.
Kieran O'Donnell, good morning to you.
Good morning, Donald.
It's a lovely day out there.
Are you enjoying the sunshine?
Absolutely. I mean, why wouldn't you? Now, I know there are probably certain members of the agricultural community are starting to think at this stage, we could do just a little moisture now for the crops.
Yeah.
But no.
As long as if it rains at night time, then it's not so bad.
Do you know what? Do you know, I absolutely agree with you. If we get a system going where we get this during the day and it can pelt down between 3 and 6.
Yeah.
Between 3 and 6
a.m. We'll take that.
Yeah. Between 3 and 6 a.m. Pelt down between 3 and 6 and then, yeah, absolutely. That's it sorted. Okay, climate, do your thing. Kieran, a busy business matters as always this morning. We're starting off with a potentially very important one, and that's free higher education courses available.
Yes, Donald, thousands of free and subsidised higher education places will be available to people in Donegal, and that is part of the 2023 Springboard Plus and Pillar 1 of the Human Capital Initiative, better known as HCI. A total of 393 places across 17 courses have been allocated to ATU Donegal under both initiatives. 32% of all the courses nationwide will run entirely online and 67% through blended learning. That all means people in Donegal will have access to hundreds of courses across the country, which is good news.
And this is one of those sort of throwbacks from COVID where now there is so much more emphasis being put on Zoom and things like that, that it is opening up these new areas of opportunity that weren't there before. Let's move on to Moville and a major award for a company there.
Yeah, congratulations to Patrick McLaughlin, his wife Marina, and all the team at Silver Strand Ropeworks Limited in Moville, who were crowned regional winners at this year's National Enterprise Awards held in Dublin on Thursday last. Patrick was a guest on Business Matters Donald last month. He set up his business at the age of 17, around the same time he was selling his leaving certificate back in 1990. Back in December, Silver Strand Ropes, which is the only producer of rope in Ireland, was announced as the overall winner at the Donegal Enterprise Awards. So a massive award for himself and his team. And I really enjoyed my visit down there a few weeks ago. Very modest, unassuming man. He employs about 10 people, but a great success story and well-deserved.
And speaking of local boys, made good a busy time for Letterkenny man Cathal Geoghegan as well.
Yeah. Letterkenny man Cathal Geoghegan has been appointed as a director and board member at Irish Food Service Suppliers Alliance based at Newton Abbey. Cahill is Managing Director at Henderson Food Service and was recently elected President of the Northern Ireland Chamber of Commerce and Industry.
Now, a lot of people looking to buy premises and buildings around the county. And if anyone ever fancied owning an old Coast Guard station, yeah, now they can.
Now's your chance. The former Coast Guard station in Boncrana has been placed on the market with a reserve price of €200,000. The station was built around 1870 and the sale is being handled by Sean Fury Auctioneers based in Boncrana.
Major investment at Canny and Doherty's in Carn.
Yeah, they've launched this revamped store following an investment of €1 million. The store employs 75 people and following the revamp, an additional 10 roles will be created within the store. Canny and Doherty's supervisor is independently owned by Gerry Doherty and has been in business for over 40 years.
Now, let's move on to this week's podcast and your guest this week, a man that you and I would have knocked about with a fair bit back in the early days. Yeah. And when I say early days, I mean early days.
I think I'm still in the era of manual typewriters, Donal.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure the way you got your news together here was much...
It was a lot different, yes.
Yeah, it was much more labour intensive.
In fairness, we were right up with modern technology. We had a fax machine.
I remember the fax machine coming up to the Donegal People's Press Office sunny day in 1990. I still think it's one of the best inventions, even though obviously technology has come on a lot, but... There you are, the fax machine. Yeah, my guest this week, Donal, is the owner of Colm Kill Press in Derry and spokesperson for the Derry University Group, Garwin Downey. A former journalist with the Irish News, the Sunday Times, the Belfast Telegraph and the Derry Journal, he was also the editor of the Derry News. In 2005, Garwin moved into the publishing sector through Guildhall Press, and 3 years ago he set up a Colm Kill Press, and his latest publication, The Handy Wee Guide to Derry, has just gone on sale. Garwin is currently working on 25 books and is planning to have 4 of those published before the end of the year. Here, Garwin talks about the difference between the world of journalism and the role of a book publisher.
After I left journalism per se, it took me a wee while to settle down and realise that not everything is a deadline and not everything has to be done, particularly within radio. You're doing bulletins every hour, or it can be even more regular, it can be every half hour, and it's like you're getting an adrenaline hit all that time. And I don't think it could be good for you to be doing that for all your life. And you don't really get a chance to get an overview, a helicopter view of what you're doing, what your big product is going to become, or what you're doing with your life even, and what your, I suppose, macro projects are. And you're just running from short-term project to short-term project. So I like then to be able to step back. First, and when I went back in the newspaper, I liked the fact I was editing a newspaper twice a week, which was good. It wasn't too hectic. It allowed you to think, to develop ideas and develop and constantly improve. Whereas you don't get that with radio at all. It's so instant. And then when you do books are, they're generally kind of, they're projects that last a year or possibly 2 years. So there's an awful lot of thought goes on them, and then an awful lot of care goes on them, and a lot of thought goes into them. And I have to say, I kind of prefer that longer process.
Food for thought, Kieran, particularly for ourselves. And I have to say, for me, I am looking forward to hearing this one really, you know, and I'll be on it first thing this afternoon.
Yeah, look, we covered a lot of ground. Our paths were across at different stages as well during the years. I suppose one of the things I asked him about stories that came to mind, that I suppose 1983, I suppose it was a year of a very contrasting fortunes for Derry. He talked about the Grey Steel murders and the funerals, and he also talked about Derry winning the Sam Maguire in that same year, Donal.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose I asked him too about, you know, the process of somebody coming to him and having a conversation about a book and the time scale from then to the book going on the shelf. Average 2 years between research, writing, editing and proofing. And a man who pays a big attention to detail, and he also talked about the importance of other people reading your work and making sure that it was 100%.
And you more than most will know the importance of good editing.
Yeah, and look, it was funny, you know, it was with similarities in some ways, but he's really enjoying what he's doing now. I was just thinking, 25 books is a fair workload at the minute, Donal, and 4 of those he's hoping to have out by the end of the year. Pat McGuire's memoirs is one of those 4 books, and I'm definitely looking forward to seeing it. Just, he's also a spokesperson for the Derry University Group, mm-hmm. As well, Donal. And a few pointers, he said, Belfast have 83% of the third level student at the minute, compared to, say, Dublin having 40% and London 20%. And he described Belfast as overheating in that regard. And he was also of the view that Derry hasn't progressed as much as it really should have had since the Good Friday Agreement. So a lot of food for thought. We covered a lot of ground, and I really enjoyed the conversation with Gerwin.
And that's now available as a podcast on highlandradio.com. And yep. If you would rather listening to it on the radio?
Yeah, goes out on Sunday evening, Donal, after the 6 o'clock news.
And Kieran, if anyone wants to make contact with yourself to discuss a potential story or a potential feature, how can they do so?
Yeah, just send me an email, please, donalbusinessmatters@highlandradio.com.
Kieran, as always, it's a pleasure. That's Kieran O'Donnell there. That was our Business Matters feature for this morning. Don't forget, Garvin Donnelly, that podcast available now on our website, highlandradio.com. It'll be broadcast on air, as we said, on Sunday evening after the 6 o'clock news. The 9 to the noon show on Highland Radio. We are into the final 10 or 11 minutes of the programme. A few very quick comments. Caller just wanted to point out the service they received in the emergency department on Monday was unbelievable service from start to finish. A total of an hour and a half, then back in the car sorted. Then a lovely male nurse really looked after them. Just a wee word of thanks. They get a lot of criticism, with which I have to disagree this time. Thanks again. In fairness, I don't think it's the staff that gets the criticism. It's the system that gets the criticism. Sometimes if you go in there at the right time, you can be done with relatively speedily, and we all hear the nightmare stories all the time. If you were able to be in and out of there in an hour and a half, that is wonderful to know. We discussed hemochromatosis earlier on our Wellness Wednesday spot. Caller says, I was diagnosed with hemochromatosis 9 years ago following my brother's diagnosis. It turns out that 5 out of 6 of us have it, plus my nephew. I had experienced unexplained constant fatigue all my life, but just kept going. I now have regular venesection, and I'm so grateful that my heart, liver and pancreas are protected. I enjoy a healthy lifestyle. I walk every day, eat very little red meat, but eat vegetables high in iron in moderation. Thanks to that caller for highlighting the condition. That's Moira Jackson that joined us there from the Hemochromatosis Association. Now the caller says, I'm with Revolut. They're asking me for a PPS number. Is this now a requirement? I'm extremely concerned that if I give this, I will be scammed. I'm just concerned with what they can do with this number. I understand you only had to enter it if you were seeking a loan from them, but I am not. I can't answer the question, caller, but what I will say is handle with care. I do have a Revolut account. I'm a relative newcomer to Revolut. My children finally dragged me kicking and screaming into Revolut. I actually find it excellent. I find, personally, that if Revolut are communicating with me, they don't communicate via text. They sort of communicate through the actual app on the phone itself. I've not been asked for a PPS number. Now, I'm in the same. I have never sought a loan from them. I would approach with caution, and if necessary, go into the Revolut website, look it up there, and see what the story is. Now, our final feature on the programme this morning is cross-border research that's setting out a pathway for integration of Gaelic games. Dr. Kate Liston is joining us on the line. Now, Dr. Kate is a researcher with Ulster University and, more importantly, is a multiple All-Ireland winner and All-Star in Gaelic football, so she knows what she's talking about. Dr. Katie, good morning.
Good morning, Donal. How are you?
Very well indeed, thank you. The research you're undergoing is the potential of integration of Gaelic games to make it more inclusive and potentially forming a new association to do this. How is this research going to be carried out, and where do you think it's going?
So the research is already underway. I'm working as part of a research team with Aoife Lane, who has a background in the women's GPA, which some of your listeners will know merged with the GPA very recently, and also Conor Myler, known in the men's Gaelic football world for his work with Tyrone. But in our world, he's also a PhD researcher down at the Technological University of Shannon. So together, Aoife, Conor and I felt that there was a need to try and understand and learn from mergers and integration processes in other sports, Donal, but also in other parts of the world. So over the last couple of months, we have been reviewing that research. We have been speaking to stakeholders who were involved in the establishment of Golf Ireland, which is a new entity also based on equality. And what we've done is try to draw those insights together in this policy research down the line. We're hoping to talk much more to members of the Gaelic Games family over the coming months, and that'll be part of Conor's work as part of his PhD research. But for today, we're highlighting what we think are 5 main recommendations, one of which you've just mentioned, Donal, is the potential to build a new organisation for Gaelic games that would be underpinned by the principle of equality. I suppose the main reason why we're saying this is that we feel that a new organisation could be much more than just the simple sum of the best bits of the three organisations, so the GAA, the Camogie Association and Ladies Gaelic Football. And it would also then give an opportunity for very real structural reform as part of that process.
A lot of people will be surprised to hear this, because I would have assumed that the LGFA was sort of a group within the GAA and it was already integrated. I mean, what is the relationship then between LGFA and GAA? Because, I mean, I would have, in my naivety, I would have assumed they were the same thing.
Well, you see, on the ground, where you've got clubs working really well together, Donald, in Donegal and elsewhere, the differences between them are almost imperceptible. But in the organisational setup, the Ladies Gaelic Football Association is a standalone entity. It has sole responsibility for the governance of Ladies Gaelic Football, and it's separate, autonomous from the GAA. The Camogie Association is affiliated to the GAA, and part of the reason for that is to do with the different histories, the heritage, and also probably the different sizes of the organisations. But it might also surprise the listeners today to know that the idea of integrating the three has been visited for as long as the Ladies Gaelic Football Association has been in existence. So I think it's next year. Yeah, next year is the 50th anniversary year of Ladies Gaelic Football. And the first recommendation where the GAA would enhance cooperation, if you will, with the Camogie Association was in 1971. In the late 90s, the GAA established a committee to examine ways of working with both the women's associations, that was Ladies Gaelic Football and Camogie. And then 3 years later, in 1995, the Camogie Association affiliated with the GAA. Now, in the 2000s, all three associations worked together a little bit more closely and established an integration task force. And at that stage, there was a one-county pilot scheme in eight counties, down Galway, Laois, Wexford, Limerick, Roscommon, Tip and Tyrone. And they produced an integration report in 2007. Number of recommendations, some of which maybe have happened organically, precisely for the reason that you've mentioned, that most people on the ground are getting on with building their communities, developing the sports, and more than that, offering support to the young players coming through. But as you will know, last year at the three congresses, there was an almost unanimous vote that they would formally integrate. So because this is very unique, Donal, nowhere in the world have we, when we've looked at the research, have we identified a comparable case where there is a multi-sport integration and also multi-entity. So three associations, three sports, but also, of course, with implications for the other Gaelic sports, rounders and handball, once the integration process has happened. So that was one of the reasons why we wanted to add an evidence base to it, and also to give to the Gaelic Games family something that will help them grapple with the potential issues at stake as we move forward in the integration process.
One of the challenges here, and I'm sure this is something that the research has looked at, is you've got to do it in such a way that you don't just form a situation where Ladies Gaelic Football becomes absorbed into the GAA and it'll be covered under AOB at the next meeting, and the GAA will continue on as it was with just some ladies in a room over in the corner that they have to do something about every now and again. You're going to have to make sure that integration means exactly that, that when the LGFA is absorbed into GAA, that voice that's looking after women in Gaelic football is not silenced, that women do very much have a place within that new organisation.
You're spot on, Donal. You can join the research team if you want, because it's actually one of the things that was very clear in some of the international case studies we looked at. There was women's cricket in Australia, golf in New Zealand, UK sport, where there was governmental reform that in a sense forced NGBs to come together rather than building a base of equality. And where there is that kind of hollow rhetoric around gender equality, that's the very real risk, that the women's organisation, which is typically weaker and smaller by virtue of size and a shorter history, but of course has just as much of a heritage and an identity that's been built up over time, that they might be sidelined, and indeed that women would be underrepresented in the influential decision-making position. So that's one of the recommendations and one of the reasons why we say we think there's an opportunity for a new organisation. A couple of the other things we've recommended is that we prioritise female representation, particularly over the next 5 years, and that we monitor that to see how well we could meet equality targets. That we would also develop a funding model that in the short term would prioritise investment into women's Gaelic football and camogie, and that we would then plan for what we call a full integration process. Now, that's not going to happen overnight. And we think, based on what we've learned so far, and also from what's happened in Gulf Ireland, that to do it well and to underpin it with equality could take anything up to 5 years or more.
And that, so, I fear, is going to be a conversation for a different day, because time has caught up with us. Dr. Katie, listen, I'm very sorry to cut you off, but time has beaten us. This is a fascinating subject. We will, I have no doubt, return to it. That's it from the 9 till noon show for today. Thank you to Niamh. Thank you to Caroline for producing. Thank you to everyone who participated in the programme this morning. Thanks to all our guests, to all our listeners, and most importantly, thanks to you, without whom this show wouldn't exist. John is up next around the Northwest. Greg's back tomorrow. From Donal, have a very good day.